Welcome back to 50 States of Mind. A lot has changed in the world since our last episode. Things have gotten even more dire within our democracy. So, it seemed like a great opportunity to dive back in, have difficult conversations, re-examine our preconceived notions, and be self-critical to try to understand what is really going on the ground through stories from all 50 states. I'm Ryan Bernstein, and welcome back to 50 States of Mind. Hello, 50 States of Mind listeners. Welcome back. We are so excited to be reinvigorating this conversation with you today. I'm joined by one of my all-time new favorite people who I met doing one of the best things that's ever happened to me. Brandon, where are you from and how did we meet?
Hi, my name is Brandon Michener. I am in Lynchburg, Virginia, raised in Alexandria, Virginia. And we know each other from Harry Potter Hogwarts Tournament of Houses.
And unfortunately, we've already recorded our Virginia episode. Otherwise, we'd have an expert here, born and raised Virginian. So yeah, we did meet on the Harry Potter quiz show Hogwarts Tournament of Houses. We were six of the potential contestants that were flown out to Los Angeles to compete on the show, and we are proud Slytherins in the Slytherin house. And we're here doing good PR for Slytherin right now, because Slytherins get a bad rap. But Brandon, tell me, what makes you such a Slytherin?
I think I really embody the ambitious aspect of Slytherin, a bit of the cunning as well.
That's pure Slytherin right there. You're joining us from Virginia. Can you tell me a little bit about where you live? Give me some Virginia vibes.
Currently live in Lynchburg, which is in like southern central Virginia. It is very different from northern Virginia. Northern and southern Virginia, if you didn't know anybody, you'd think they were two entirely different states. Northern Virginia, you know, it's a metropolitan community, you know, right outside of DC. Because you have such a large population there, you get a lot of different people. So I grew up around people from all walks of life, different countries. And so now living in Lynchburg, it is a very white community. There are some other ethnicities here, but it's weird walking around and not seeing a lot of Hispanic people or Middle Eastern people or Asian people. So it's been an adjustment, but I currently work at Liberty University in the library. I'm an acquisitions assistant. I purchase new books, you know, different resources for the library.
Give me a rundown of what Liberty University is to you, what it might be to other people. People have a lot of different perceptions of Liberty University, and we're all about unpacking multiple perceptions. So drop some Liberty University knowledge.
Yeah. So I was a student from 2010 until the end of 2011. I visited the school. I was a senior in high school, and I was like, wow, I really love it here. Ended up attending for a year and a half. I actually ended up getting placed on academic suspension because I skipped a lot of class and they dock points for that. So, you know, live and learn. But, you know, I loved my time there. I came back in 2014 for work. Working for Liberty has opened my eyes to a lot that goes on there.
So before we get into that, like, what is Liberty? What is Liberty University? How would people have heard of Liberty University?
Yeah. For the last 49 years. It was the world's largest Christian campus. It is also one of the biggest conservative hotbeds in the country. The school was founded by Jerry Falwell Sr. And if you don't know who that is, bless you. Jerry Falwell Sr. made a lot of people angry. He said a lot of hateful stuff. He was very involved with the moral majority. He built his platform initially on keeping segregation going. He was against civil rights. And he eventually did walk that back. He founded a private school, Liberty Christian Academy. It was known as something else when it was founded, but it's now known as Liberty Christian Academy. And it was founded with the hope that there would be a Christian place for white kids to go. You know, he didn't want white kids going to school with black kids. And there's been a, like, people say, oh, well, you know, he changed, and maybe he did. But my thing is, when, if you say, well, you know, I'm walking these ideas back, and, you know, now I'm allowing black students to come to my school. Sure, maybe, but you're also getting more money funneled into your school if you let black people come to the school. So maybe it's just because I'm so distrusting, but I feel like there could have been an ulterior motive there. I mean, up until the mid-90s, if a black student, particularly a black male, wanted to date a white female student, the white female student had to get permission, written permission from her parents in order to do that. And that was in the mid-90s.
So, okay, you're black, I'm white. So we could not have gone to school together up until when?
Late 70s. Yeah, when it was first founded, we would not have been able to go to school together.
With Liberty University, was that always integrated, or was there a point where it became integrated?
Details on this are a little sketchy. They say it wasn't founded with the purpose of, you know, prohibiting black students from attending the school. But black students did not attend the school until, I'd say it was like probably late 70s before black students really started attending.
On this podcast, you know, we're all about seeing multiple sides of multiple issues, but there are some issues like that one that is just plain wrong. That being said, there's a reason you went there. There's a reason you work there. What do you like about Liberty University?
All right, let me unpack that a little bit. At its core, I like the idea of it. You know, a Christian college. Right now, though, I don't know that that's being done. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on at the school right now. You know, people probably heard, what was it, last year, the whole shakeup with Jerry Jr. and the whole pool boy scandal. So that was a very fun time for us. It got to the point every time we saw that we were trending in the news, because the library's name is the Jerry Falwell Library. So people would call the library to like yell at Jerry, thinking that he worked there. Library's named after his father, but like they would call the library. And every time we saw that we were trending in the news, our first thing was, can we just unplug the phones for like 24 hours, please? When I worked on in the like customer service side of the library, and I had to answer phones, when he was still president of the school, and you know, he would say some outlandish stuff. I have been on the receiving end of some very interesting phone calls. Like one guy cussed me out. It was like, I want you to tell Jerry that. And it's like, I don't have access to this man. I don't know what to tell you. At its core, I like the idea of it, but look, that's just not what's happening. You know, it's these people are part of a larger culture that surrounds the school. And unless you can address that culture at the school, nothing is going to change.
So I have kind of two questions, but I'm just kind of going to walk my way into it. So Liberty University is, I mean, it's not just a bastion of Christianity. It also is the place where Ted Cruz announced his presidential ambitions. Famously, it was at Liberty University where Donald Trump said to Corinthians, right? That's one of my favorite moments. The first question is, do you feel like Christianity and sort of politics and culture wars have started to get into bed together, no pun intended, at Liberty? And then the second question is, what does a Christian college as an ideal mean to you? I know it's small, easy questions.
Yeah. So first off, something that I've been saying for a few years now is that the worst thing that has ever happened to Christianity is its principles becoming so fused with conservative ideals that the two are almost indistinguishable at this point. The moral majority is largely responsible for this, Jerry Falwell Sr. included. He wanted to make a platform because initially he didn't want Christians to get involved with politics. You know, he was largely against civil rights, but, you know, the attitude in the 70s, that was changing, and he knew he couldn't build a platform on that. Abortion is what he built his platform on. And
opposition to abortion, obviously.
Right. Opposition to abortion. Abortions. Right, right.
Yeah.
And initially, he said, well, that's not a church problem. That was his initial stance, and then that changed. And that is really what led up to what the evangelical conservative base looks like today. There are a lot of people that think that because there are Christians who support conservative ideals, that conservative ideals are quote unquote right. No pun intended. A lot of people have these blinders on to things that conservatives do that, especially Christian conservative politicians, and they really can't acknowledge when, you know, they're doing wrong things, or, you know, they'll stand by them, ignore the wrongs that they do in defense of, you know, conservative ideals, those evil liberals, especially where abortion is concerned. It has created a lot of problems with the Christian faith in general, because a lot of people just can't tell the difference between what conservative ideals are and what Christian ideals are. And it's sad, it's unfortunate, because that's not the things that I've seen from some Christians, like, that's not what I think the faith represents. It makes me so angry, like, seeing, you know, like, Westboro Baptist Church on the news, and they're, like, screaming all these hateful messages, and it's like, okay, all right, you do realize that the goal is to draw people to Christ.
Side note about Westboro Baptist. Did you know that Westboro Baptist is not like a mega church? It's this sad little man's house in a neighborhood that's like a fortress. I drove by it on this trip, and I was picturing like Joel Osteen's church. Like, it had some sort of following. It's just like one sad little family, and people keep leaving. So that's kind of a metaphor. So not to get too heavy, but like, what is Christianity? What does the faith mean to you?
So I actually didn't become a Christian until I was 18. And like, I grew up in church. Like, I attended church like my entire life. In fact, that's why I wanted to attend Liberty, because I love the atmosphere and it was a Christian environment, but I wasn't a Christian. And I had some really big emotional upheaval when I got to college. Just to give you some background. So my father was almost never present. He was around very briefly for like 2 years. And I have a non-existent relationship with my father. I have not seen him. It's been over 16 years at this point, the last time I saw him. My father is a cop, or was a cop at one point. And to make it even better, he's also a pastor. And he has 1, 2, 4 other kids. We all have different mothers. And, you know, he didn't have all of us while he was a pastor, but some of us he did. It really, and I internalized a lot of this growing up. Like, it upset me so much that this guy who's supposed to be a pastor, who's supposed to be a spiritual leader, who's supposed to be doing the right thing, wasn't. Like, I resisted Christianity for a long time because I couldn't reconcile how my father treated me and what he was doing, with him also being a pastor. And, you know, when you bury your emotions, they will eventually come back out, usually in very ugly ways. And that's what happened to me my freshman year of college. But yeah, I try and live out my life in such a way so that people will be comforted. I can't understand how people can, you know, spew all this hatred when forgiveness is supposed to be, you know, a huge part of the faith. Be loving and be forgiving towards people. Like, that's the main thing. And why aren't you doing that?
It is something that I think so many people can identify with. The rage you feel when you see people who are supposed to be in positions of authority and they're doing the opposite of what you're supposed to be doing, and you don't feel like there's any accountability. This is a smaller example, but part of the reason I decided to kind of suspend the podcast is because it was around the election. Everything was too sensitive. Everyone was like, that rage came out in everyone, and I was like, this is not a way to have a conversation. And one of those moments was I was on Facebook, and this woman who I grew up with, who's a very conservative Christian woman, posted something about Dr. Rachel Levine, who's first transgender government appointee, and just like how disgusting is this person? And then people going off and going off and just like saying nasty things. And I just commented and I was like, hey, I was always taught to stand up to bullies, and here you are, an adult, bullying someone online. I don't think this is cool. And she came back and she was like, I raised my kids to be conservative Christians, and this is the way I live. I was like, lady, I knew what your daughter was doing in middle school. She was not such a conservative Christian. And just the thing, and it kind of all comes back to the Falwells. It comes back to, we all do disgusting, stupid, rageful, treacherous shit.
Yeah.
And all of these ideals, you know, here's a God coming to earth in the human body to show us that we can live these certain ideals when we all personally fail. I feel like there's none of that. I mess up a lot. I make a lot of mistakes. It's sort of infused with the energy of the Christian church right now. Some of the very best people I know are Christians. And the people that can level with you, I don't know if I've talked about this on this podcast, but I think I have. Mm-hmm. But the pastor that I spoke to was just like, yeah, I can't tell you if God's real. I can tell you I've become a better person having been a pastor. I've changed lives. I've seen people's lives changed through the faith. I've fought for the most vulnerable among us in the Christian faith. And I can't tell you that I'm, you know, a better person than anyone else, or that God is real for sure. And I just, that sort of transparency is... You need to be really in touch with your emotions. You need to be in touch with your own sinfulness in order to be able to articulate that. And it's people that have something to hide, I think, generally, that are the worst holier-than-thou people. Am I wrong?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely not.
Yeah, it's a problem. And I just think that politics and religion coming together in any shape or form is just ugly, because politics is so disgusting and messy in its own way, no matter what party you're a part of. Yeah. And religion is confusing and a very personal journey. And to mix the two, absolutely no bueno. But okay, so last thing I'll say before we transition to what state we're talking about. Can you tell me an anecdote about going to Liberty or working at Liberty that's just like a positive thing, a positive relationship you've built there?
Yeah, his name's Mike. He's a librarian at the school. And I don't remember really how it started. We've built a rapport with each other. And, you know, I would frequently, you know, stop by his office, you know, just to talk. We serve on one of the library's committees together. And at some point, he was like, you know, can I just ask you something? I was like, yeah, sure, go ahead. And, you know, it just kind of, it built from there. I told him that, look, I am one Black person with a unique experience. I am not the voice for the Black community, and I just need you to keep that in mind. So, you know, when I talk about things, this is from, you know, my own perspective. And, you know, we would talk in his office for, you know, like an hour. And finally, I was like, you know what? Let's have lunch. I enjoy talking about what my experience as a Black man in America has been, and just trying to provide some insight on what being Black in America is like, the best that I can, at least, to people who kind of don't get it. And I tell them, you know, feel free to ask questions, you know, and they've expressed thankfulness for it because they've also been scared to also do that as well, because they're like, well, you know, I don't want someone to call me racist because I asked something. And, you know, I say, look, you know, I can tell the difference between blatant racism and ignorance. Like, if you're ignorant about something, you know, okay, that's one thing. To me, ignorance and racism, they present themselves in two very different ways. I've not gotten racist anything from any of the people I've had lunch with.
I think that's really great, because it's easy to make a mistake or ask the wrong thing. And I think the spirit of forgiveness is really awesome. And I think this all leads into the state we're going to talk about today and the interview we're going to talk about today, which is really one of my favorite interviews I got on the entire trip. And I'll tell a story about it before we dive into that. But so my question for you is about the state we're going to be talking about today. And that is, what do you know, Brandon, about the state of Tennessee?
I believe that Nashville is like the country music capital of the country. The Grand Ole Opry is located in Nashville. What else? Appalachian Mountains run through Tennessee. Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis.
Correct. Those are so probably all the things that I knew about Tennessee before I went there. And you're correct. It is the country music capital, but it is also just the plain old capital. And at this point in my trip, you know, I'd had a lot of interviews set up. This is maybe the midpoint, but I got really ballsy. If I couldn't find an interview, I just went to the capital, the Tennessee State Capitol, which happened to be an inauguration. And I just wandered in as a layperson, and I was in the Senate or state representative chamber, and I sort of looked at the goings on and I started taking pictures, and one of the state representatives noticed me. He's like, what the hell are you doing? Are you taking pictures of me? I was like, yeah, I'm traveling to all 50 states, just trying to, you know, soak up the, you know, local atmosphere. And he's like, all right, come to my office for an interview. Let's have an interview. And this is Representative Joe Towns Jr., state rep in the state of Tennessee from Memphis. We had this interview, which we're about to talk about. But what I don't think is mentioned is the interview ended and he said, what are you doing tonight? I was like, well, you know, I'm just going to explore the town. He's like, you're coming to the inauguration party. So he invited me to the inauguration party for the Tennessee State Legislature. And we basically went out together, got buck wild, hung out. And the conversation deepness that I thought was a 10 on this interview got to like a 15 as we were bar hopping through the country music capital. So anyway, just some context about what an awesome person Representative Joe Towns Jr. is. So I'm going to play the recording, then we'll have a chat about it. Please state your name and sure. What you do here in Tennessee.
Well, actually, my name is Joe, last name Towns, T-O-W-N-S, Jr., and I'm an elected official at the state level. I'm a state legislator for the 84th District, Shelby County, which is considered also Shelby County, Memphis, Tennessee. And I've served in this capacity for, really, this will be my 25th year, and 26th when I concluded as a representative for that particular district, District 84, Memphis, Tennessee. And I've served primarily on the Education Committee. I used to chair that before the Republicans took over. I chaired K-12 and insurance and banking, those kind of committees where I've actually served for very long. And, you know, been a community worker for a long time. Started probably in high school. Civics probably started me to get involved in my community. I guess that was the setup because I enjoyed civics. I didn't understand a lot of stuff as a young person, ninth grade, then student government, okay? Involved in student government and high school. From college, got involved, became the freshman class president, sophomore class president, president of the Panhellenic Committee, served on the Presidential Advisory Committee when I was a youngster in college. And then I began to work in the communities, civic-minded, working a lot of free volunteering stuff to change the community, and began to manage campaigns. Okay, one of my former friends who served in this body, one of the youngest legislators, his name was Teddy Willard, served here. He's no longer with us, may God bless his soul. I began to manage this campaign with campaigns at that time. I was, I don't know, very young. That gave me the incentive to get involved in politics even in a more aggressive way. Probably, you know, there's some other things we'll get into that really put the spark under me as a young person wanting to change this country, because this country is different than what it used to be, okay? But that's kind of, you know, scratching the surface on a little bit of background. I don't know if the rest of your question.
Oh, that's great. Jumping off of that, what was the bridge from managing campaigns to being a candidate yourself?
Well, being a candidate myself was something that I always knew I wanted to do, okay? But when you are, I guess, when you're younger, you don't really understand how to do it, because there's always money involved. You got to have a certain amount of money. Okay, we had the energy to outwork everybody, but the money that was required, didn't see how to put that together. So you do enough stuff and enough people begin to learn you, who you are in the community, you think you have a better chance because you built up some name record. So I knew everybody because I'd worked every, getting, you know, groomed and processed and learning the players. However, when you're that young, the players are not going to be with you. Mm-hmm. They were never with me, okay, because I would be considered an outsider bucking the system, of the established system of those that are in office. They're not going to take on a young cat like me because they have other alliances that have been old alliances with them. So we just decided to run. After I started managing, beating everybody, I managed a number of campaigns, city council campaigns, county commissioner campaigns, state representative campaign. Putting people in, you learn how to do it. And you become a force once you start winning that people respect. You become a force that people respect. So at that point, I developed the apparatus and my team. We were able to skillfully, without the money, as much money, beat some guys. And I've had opposition almost every time in this particular seat, and we beat them. I think the least amount of vote in a three-way race I got, maybe 57, between 57 and 60%, you know. But the leap was that I learned how to, from working in the community for the people, kind of where that is.
Yeah. You just mentioned that the country's different now than it was 40 years ago. In what ways do you see that here in Tennessee?
You said 40 years ago?
Oh, I can't remember the number you said.
I didn't give a number. I think you're trying to be cute. Are you trying to age me, man?
What's up? Well, you look younger than 40. So
come on, Oxford. Come on, Oxford. That's what they teach you over in Oxford, man. But no, actually, you're right. I'll tell you a story. Well, obviously, the country is better. In a lot of ways, we still have our challenges based upon the current politic in the White House, okay? The racial strife is better than what it was. However, it's still trying to rear its hideous head again with a lot of these alt-right, alt-bright, whatever these knucklehead groups are. So you hear some of that stuff today. The advent of the internet is allowing a lot of this stuff to flourish, but still the country is better. We've made progress. And I think that in the white community, white people are more apt and aggressive to fight this than they were 50 years ago, 60 years ago. White people were afraid of other white people, mm-hmm. okay, to get out and do it, because their community, they were socialized and go to church, go to work, go to school, to study other with certain people, so they were afraid. White people not afraid to fight that crap today. If there's a Klan march, okay, you can find more white people in that march against that crap, okay, all right, than the law allows, and that's a good thing. That's progress. So what that is, that's courage, and that's an understanding of that human beings that come to Earth ordered by, I believe in God, ordered by the Creator to send us to this planet in any color, shape, form, or fashion it wants to, okay? And you have nothing to do with it. You can't order yourself, okay?
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do to order yourself. It doesn't work. The universe doesn't work like no animal, no plant, no microscopic organism, none of it. We don't order ourselves, okay? You know, but the fact of it is that it was the dark. This is the anniversary year last year of Dr. King's murder in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Okay. 1968, April what? I think the 15th or something like that. Okay. April, got the exact date. 50 years. It's a different country. Okay. But because it has changed and it's a different country, does not mean that you can sit back and relax on your laurels and think the work is done. Had an opportunity to be with Joe Biden maybe 3 months ago. He was at the Orpheum Theater in Memphis, Tennessee. And this is profound, part of what he stated. He said, I thought we had taken care of those problems. People having the right to vote with the Voting Rights Act. I thought we'd taken care of those problems of race and these kinds of things that you see cropping up today. He said, he went through a litany of things that he said, I thought we had taken care of, meaning that we thought the country dealt with those things. Mm-hmm. But the point being, okay, yes, the country dealt with those things at that particular time. However, ugliness, diabolical activity, never goes asleep. It's never permanently put out of business, which means that people have to always be vigilant and watch for that kind of activity. Yes, we dealt with it, but there's another crew being bred because of the evil that lies and the iniquity that lies in human beings, okay? Yes, it was taken care of, okay? But not permanently, okay? We can never move from being vigilant of what's happening in your world, in your community. Evil people still abound, okay? All over the world, not just in this country, but all over the world. Yes, we took it, but it was a shocker to him that some of the things, and he's an older man, he's 75, I believe, but it was a shocker to him that those things that we, as a country, had dealt with seem to be resurfacing, and they are, okay? So young guys and gals of goodwill have to always be ready to fight for what's right. You gotta be ready to fight for what's right. In the 60s, this country was going to hell in a handbasket, okay? Presidents being murdered, president's brothers being murdered, Dr. King being murdered, Malcolm X being murdered. This was a killing field, a major proportion. You weren't born then, okay? But they were knocking off in this country. That's like a third world country. Can you imagine the damn president of your country being knocked off, then his brother being knocked off, and then a major leader like Dr. King being knocked off in a third world country? We would look at that place today and say, what the hell is going on over there? Well, that happened in America, brother.
Yeah.
Okay? That happened in America. That happened in America. That happened in this country, and it wasn't too long ago. Okay? They were knocking them off, okay? In public places, knocking them off, okay?
63 through 68, 5 years of high-profile murders.
Well, he had thugs and gangsters, racists and knuckleheads in control of this country. And that's what these bastards would be doing that's spewing all this venom, okay, today. They would be doing the same thing. They were straight-up criminal thugs that were in charge. CIA thugs. FBI and these people back in the day, they were thugs, okay, misusing and targeting people because of what they believe in the minority community. They were thugs, gangsters that we're paying a salary to come in and oppress us, cheating with the votes, okay, with some of the same stuff you see today, with the taxes that they're utilizing, okay? All right, you know, giving you a bean test, how many beans of jelly beans in this jar, all this kind of foolishness. Cheney and Warren and the other kid that got murdered down there, okay? Mm-hmm. All this was happening in this country, okay? So when you look at that and you compare it to what's happening today, we've come a long ways, but there's yet a ways to go, and we have to look at what's happening today. See, if you have no sense of what has happened at that particular point in time, that evil can sneak up on you, okay? It can sneak up on you. Now, I'm going to tell you, America's not perfect, but it's a pretty good place, okay? Unless you let these sapsuckers mess it up, okay? You can mess up heaven, okay? So I believe in heaven. Satan almost messed it up, okay? That's why he had to get kicked out, okay? This is not heaven, but these suckers can mess it up. If you let too many of them get in the wrong place in terms of position and so forth and come up with all this old ignorant, evil policy, it'll mess it up. And so this is the danger. If it's messed up, where in the hell do we go? Who's going to take Americans? We're not fleeing. Where do we go? There's nowhere to go. You're not going to Mars. You're not going to go live on the moon, okay? Where do you go? There's nowhere for you to go. So that means what? You have to fix it right here. That means you have to roll your sleeves up and be ready to put this right a club right across the sucker's head and make him do right. You got to make him do right, okay? You have to deal with them according to the law. You have to lay the smack down on them, okay? You have to deal with it. You got to be aggressive with it. And even though you're being aggressive, you want to do it in a compassionate way, okay? Because if I love my family, I love my friends, I love my children, I love whomever, you know, as a man that I love, my woman, this, that, another, because I love you, I'm not going to allow you to run over me, okay? If you're wrong, you are wrong, and we got to straighten it out if you're wrong, okay? Can't let you get away with wrong, because wrong always leads to more evil stuff. So the point of it is that young people and Americans and people have to be ready to stand in the gap and fight it at all costs, because we have nowhere else to go, man. Mm-hmm. There's nowhere else we're going, okay, yeah. But to hell and a handbasket if they mess it up, okay? And the thing about it now, once you let it get messed up, it may take you 1,000 years to undo that nonsense, okay? So it's better to go on and fight it and deal with it. And we have to watch the internet and all this stuff, this poison, And some of this stuff is a bunch of cockamamie, it's a bunch of nonsense that people spew. And how people believe and follow it, I will never know. But people will follow the most ignorant thing in the world, okay? There are people out there, you can come up with rocks got ears or rocks got brains. You're going to have a crew of people going to follow that nonsense, okay? Human beings are fickle, okay? When you really look at them, look at the movie with Jim Jones, okay? You know about the Jim Jones deal? Something you need to study. Jim Jones was a guy, this crazy guy, come up with all this crazy stuff. I guess it was a Haley Bob comet, or Jim Jones was another day, but you had another guy with Haley Bob comet, and some comet gonna come in and take us all out from the spaceship. These folks drinking poison, kill themselves. Jim Jones, I think, that sucker even killed a congressman, a group of people going on. People follow anybody and anything, okay? And they all died, okay? They died. It really was a mass murder, okay? When you look up the Jim Jones story, okay? You know, so you have to have clear-minded leaders, compassionate leaders that believe in just doing right by human beings, okay? And create an economy where everybody can make it, okay? Everybody doesn't need to make $1 million. We're not trying to make $1 million, but everybody needs to be able to live and take care of their obligation and take care of their children and have money for health care and have money for education. And that's the thing that's gotten too expensive in our country. Education is just off the charts. It's really too much. Higher education is too much, and a good education is costing even more when it comes to even high school and so forth, good colleges and high school. But, you know, you have to have leaders that have the wisdom and the compassion to understand how to lead and create a canopy that allows all of this stuff to fester while also chastising and correcting people that are doing wrong and doing it in a way where if they're redeemable, they can redeem themselves, okay? Yeah. You know, but the country's different. I guess I'll share this with you. Maybe we do this one day in your podcast. When Dr. King was murdered in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968, the shot woke me up as a child. I lived there on Mulberry Street, okay? The hotel is about as far as here to that building right there on the end, okay? I used to play there. I was that close. All right, my grandmother was on her knees looking out the window. When she heard it, she said, "I bet that's Dr. King," okay? Now, my grandmother knew what was going on. I didn't. Okay, I'm right there with my grandmother. Right there, the hotel right there, okay? On the left side of the street. I live at 375. Hotel is right down the street there, not even a block. So that's not a block. I heard, pow. I remember, pow. It was a rifle. That echo, okay? I just jumped up. I never heard anything that loud, I guess. I'm lying on the floor watching television. And sure enough, Dr. King had been murdered, assassinated, okay? And that was obviously a stain on Memphis, Tennessee, a stain on the country, the United States. One of the best people, if not the best, that this country's ever produced for love and trying to bring people together and righting a wrong and standing up for the poor. He was in the city because of the insensitive treatment of the sanitation workers by a city with, at that time, a mayor by the name of Loeb. Henry Loeb was a dirty, I hated the man as a kid. He was a dirty dog, okay? He was a dirty dog. He was a bastard is what he was, okay? Evil man, as far as I'm concerned. As a kid, didn't like him at all. I could have whooped his ass back then. I'd whooped his ass, okay? Because I didn't like it, man. He was scary looking. There's a meeting that he was having with preachers in my community, okay? And I saw this picture. He's in a meeting with a bunch of African-American preachers, and that son of a gun, he's got a shotgun on the floor, okay? That's a despicable son of a gun to me, okay? I didn't like him. And then his family still was there. And one of his offspring was down to Kegels Island making disparaging remarks about those people down there. You can Google that stuff out there. Loeb and Kegels Island. She was a member of the chamber. It was just horrible, that kind of conduct. That's a part of the ugliness that still exists in this country, that mindset that still exists in this country. But you got a man meeting with ministers, and you got a damn shotgun on the floor, okay? I didn't like that man. I'm just a kid now. But there's something about him I despise because I saw evil in him, and evil's still around, okay? But, you know, that I used to march in the Rise as a kid. My training came from being a kid in the Rise with my mother, okay? Because she was an activist in the community, okay? They sprayed tear gas in the marches and so forth. That's where I first saw Coretta Scott King after Dr. King was murdered. Okay, I was in that march, okay? I remember her with a black veil on, a dress marching, because Dr. King wanted to do a peaceful march in Memphis, Tennessee, and it didn't happen because he was murdered. So she came back to do it, Harry Belafonte. I can remember Harry Belafonte because I was selling papers as a kid, okay? Downtown on Main Street, that's how I made my money. It was a Memphis World paper. That was an African-American paper, like the Tri-State. I used to sell the Tri-State. The Memphis World paper, okay? That's how I made my money as a kid, my little hustle, and go to store for people and sell bottles and all that kind of stuff, you know, as a kid. But I remember that march, okay? I remember one march we were involved in. We left there running with my mother around because they'd broken out. It was the first march because there was tear gas that they sprayed on us, okay? And the police were crooked as hell. The whole system was set up against African-American people. The entire system was set up, okay, just crooked from A to Z. It was our apartheid in this country, okay? The same thing was happening in South Africa was happening in this doggone country at the same time, okay? Our movement outran there. I mean, I'll paste this, but it was the same apartheid system in this country. We like to talk about South Africa. You had that same stuff here in this country, okay? And if you understand the history of it, which is something I hated when I was younger, okay, because I didn't understand it. I didn't understand history. But as a man, I eat it like eating a bowl of good gumbo because it gives you a clear picture of what's happening, okay? I hated it, okay? But I love it now. But you had the same thing in this country, okay? Tricking you out your money, you can't get a job. It was just a horrible system, especially for African American people and poor people too. Okay, oppressive, regressive, punitive, crooked, all kind of diabolical stuff they would do to set you up, bugging your phone, bugging your bed, bugging your business, turning people against each other. They did it all. Who ought to be indicted? We should have been J. Edgar Hoover and all them other dirty low down folk that were doing all this dirty stuff to citizens. Because really, we're talking about democracy. What it was a communist system, okay? It was a communist system because of what they were doing with their power, okay? We were democracy on paper, but the democracy was just unilateral. It was just on one side of the fence. There was no damn democracy for the rest of the folk in this country, okay? And poor white people were getting messed over every day themselves. Didn't nobody give a damn about them, but they didn't see it because these other puppeteers played the race card, okay, on everybody, okay? And it still happens today. The dog whistles that Trump do, he's playing the race card himself with other white people, okay? They've always done it, okay? And people that don't think don't see how they've been manipulated and pimped. The team ought to be poor people. That's the reason Dr. King was talking about dealing with this poor people's campaign, okay? The team ought to be poor people. Economic issues for poor people. What the hell are poor people going to get out of the deal? The poor people are the one that pay for every damn doggone thing. The poor sap is the one who pays for everything. Gets pimped, okay, all over the place by these rich suckers. Now, don't misunderstand me now. I'm not against rich people. I'd love to be one of them, okay? But I know what the agenda is, okay? Mm-hmm. The issues are never... There's no lobbyists for poor people, okay? I'm the lobbyist for poor people. Who gives a damn about poor people? Nobody comes to mind and lobby me for poor people. If I don't do it, or some other elected official doesn't do it, it doesn't get done, okay? Because it doesn't pay, okay? Because it's right to do it. Take care of the least of these, to take care of the elderly, take care of the children, do all these kinds of things. That's what I believe. That's the order of the day. That's creating a system where the canopies live and let live and assist in. You're talking about welfare. Hell, who gets the welfare? Corporations get the welfare. Then they mess up your doggone water, mess up your land, mess up your doggone fish and fowl. Look at these, man, look at the meltdown in some of these places with nuclear energy. Where do you think that water goes? It goes out in the ocean, messing up our fish. We got to eat that stuff, okay? If we can eat it, okay? They get it. Corporations get away with murder. Now you're living in a time where corporations are people. How in the hell are corporations are people? When they get to be human beings, okay? That's a game. That's abrasive to poor people and the human race when it comes to them being able to do what they want to because they're not mindful to do what they're supposed to by... As I said, we can't go to where we got one earth. When you screw this puppy, you're going to screw it yourself.
So, Brandon Long, very interesting interview. One of my favorites. Do you have any initial thoughts?
So, when he was telling the story about how he heard the gunshot that killed Dr. King, I actually resonated with that in a very odd way, not just because, you know, I'm black. And, you know, that it was such a heartbreaking thing for Black people to, you know, hear that Dr. King had been assassinated. It made me think about when I was nine. I went to school in Alexandria, Virginia, and Alexandria is about 5 miles from Arlington. And 9/11, we heard the plane hit the Pentagon. And we didn't realize it at the time. Our school was, you know, it was being renovated. And so we thought it was the construction initially. And it wasn't until later in the day, of course, when we all found out, you know, a lot of kids' parents, you know, that worked at the school worked in the city. And so, you know, of course, you know, they left work. And, you know, a lot of kids started leaving school. You know, of course, the teachers didn't tell us anything. But hearing his story about how he heard the gunshot made me think about that.
That's really interesting. Yeah, he is such an incredible memory and remembers so many events and so many historical figures and moments, and he kind of tied all of those into his assessment of the state of democracy, at least in 2018 when I interviewed him. Did anything he had to say about, you know, the state of the country resonate with you?
When he talked about, I believe he mentioned Joe Biden saying that he thought we'd taken care of those things. From my vantage point, they'd never been taken care of. Like, you know, I think for a lot of white people, 1964, which is, you know, the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, seems to be like, oh, well, things are fixed now. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Joe talked about how, like things are better now. I do not disagree with that. Things are much better. But just because people aren't being dragged out into the street and being lynched and hanged from trees, that hatred doesn't go away. You know, people talk about it behind closed doors. And, you know, they espouse these beliefs in their children. And, you know, they're not going out into the street and lynching Black people, but, you know, they still have certain ideas about Black people or, you know, just non-white people. It festers. And the way in which those ideas manifest look different than, you know, lynching people. It's, you know, in the way they treat people. People that are in positions of power, and you know, when you have power and you know you're biased against another group of people, you can impact a lot of people in some very harmful ways.
Yeah, I was really struck by the example of the mayor of Memphis when he was growing up meeting with Black church leaders holding a shotgun. I mean, Virginia, all this talk about critical race theory, what's taught in schools, maybe neither here nor there for this conversation, is incontrovertible, to quote Albus Dumbledore in Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, the movie and the trial scene, that things were unbelievably horrendous and difficult in the lifetimes of people that are alive right now. Some of those examples he brought up, I was like, had no clue. And I just don't feel like it's talked about and in our public consciousness. Either people don't want to talk about it, they feel like they don't have permission to talk about it, it's too awkward, or they don't know what to say about it in the first place. And I love how he didn't shy away from, this is what the Black experience was for me in the political sphere. He was referring to people in power like thugs.
Oh, yes. I mean, I have some opinions about law enforcement. One of the issues that I have with people in the way that they regard law enforcement is that they think because they uphold the law, they can do no wrong. That's just not true. And so because they think that they can do no wrong, they have a lot of blind spots for when they do end up committing wrongs and they just look the other way or won't acknowledge it. And the FBI in the mid-20th century, large part of that, the FBI watched and intimidated Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, the Black Panthers, and, you know, J. Edgar Hoover was horrible to Dr. King. So I am incredibly distrustful of government. I'm incredibly distrustful of just large organizations with a lot of power in general. And his point about lobbying for poor people really resonated with me, because you've got these rich politicians who aren't lobbying for the people they're supposed to represent. I've kind of gotten away from assigning myself political labels, but I would say the closest thing I probably come to is libertarian, moderate libertarian. And it blows my mind that people believe that Trump was representing their ideals. He said he was defending, you know, Christian ideals and, you know, he's making America a Christian nation again. Disclaimer, I've never once believed America is a Christian nation. If anything, most of the founding fathers weren't Christians. They were deists.
They were not evangelical Christians. That's incontrovertible.
Yeah.
And I think you bring up a really good point about libertarianism. And that's, there's sort of three ways of thinking about what the government does. And there's, here's the government's going to create something that's going to solve a problem for you. It's going to create something that's going to solve a problem. There's the other side that's like, the government cannot do anything to solve any of your problems. The free market will solve your problems. So it's sort of there. And then there's the middle. There's a sort of medium that the government should prevent the private sector. It should prevent corporations. It should prevent bad lobbyists making bad rules that stack things against you. And I think sort of the conversation's been lost a little bit. It's like, does the government create something that's going to make your life better? We can talk about what those things are, because probably not everything, probably not nothing. And then there's the, does the private sector do some things better? Absolutely. Does it take advantage of you and poison your water and, you know, screw you over? Also, yes. And there's only one thing that can counteract that, and that's the government. So I feel like having a conversation about those basic functions of government and what the government is able to accomplish is actually so tertiary now to these big culture war disputes that politics has become. And it's really not even about, like, what's the role of the federal government, state government, local government.
I have a lot of thoughts about what the government should and shouldn't do. It's a balancing act, you know, like, you can't let the private sector run rampant. So, you know, the government has to be there to prevent that. But at the same time, the government shouldn't have so much power so that it prevents private sector from doing its thing.
Well, I could talk to you about this all day, but speaking of ordinary people, I have one more recording for you, which is just something very random and weird that happened to me while I was also in Nashville. Let's hear from my friend that I met in the park.
What's your name and what do you do here in Tennessee?
My name's Chloe. And I'm actually a pediatric cardiac ICU nurse.
That's incredible. And I just heard a click. What are you doing right now?
Expelling energy.
You're
burning off of all my emotions.
Tap dancing?
Yeah, tap dancing.
How long have you been tap dancing?
Since I was a kid, since I was 3.
That's amazing. What is this routine you're doing right now? Is this just...
Just something in my head. Nothing special at all.
Amazing. Could I hear you tap?
Sure.
No pressure. Okay. I'm just, paradiddle, paradiddle, paradiddle. Yes. Is that it? Yeah?
Yes.
Paradiddle stomp.
Paradiddle stomp. Yes, that's what it is.
Did you do musical theater in high school, or are you on a team?
No, I just competitive dance growing up, and I don't know, it's just something that's kind of stuck with me. I don't know, it's hard being a nurse, just kind of trying to, like, burn off all of the emotions, so that's what I do. Yeah.
Do you have other people you tap dance with? Have you met a tap dancing community here?
Well, I started taking classes at the, like, Vanderbilt Dance Company, so I met a few people through there, but it's kind of, I enjoy it the most whenever I'm doing it by myself.
Yeah.
Okay, Brandon, that is, that's something that happened to me. Does that, trigger any emotions, feelings, rhythms in you?
Being a nurse, especially right now, is so hard. COVID is an absolute nightmare. And I'm glad that she has something that can give her, you know, a little bit of joy and help her unwind. Tap dancing. You know, I love that.
That's the best of America right there. You know, everything seems so bad, and then you meet a nurse just tap dancing in the park to get out her stress. Well, this has been an awesome conversation. I open the floor to you for anything else you want to bring up, acknowledge, talk about, refute.
Oh man. I guess if there's one thing I want to leave people with, is just talk to people. You know, a lot of us are so comfortable, you know, talking to people that agree with us that we don't really get to hear what someone else's experience has been like. And in order to get a more complete picture, you need to talk to those other people and hear where they're coming from, because the things that they believe and why they believe them are formed by their experience. And it's very easy to say, oh, well, this person is evil because they think this. Well, you got to figure out, how did they get here? And that can go a very long way into tearing down some of those preconceived notions that we have about other people. And it's an important thing to do.
Love that. You know, the world is full of different kinds of people. It's full of Hufflepuffs. It's full of Ravenclaws, Slytherins.
Also good, those self-righteous Gryffindors.
Squibs, Muggles, Elves, Goblins, all of them. They all got to live together. Thanks for listening to this episode of 50 States of Mind. The best way you can help is to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or just share with your friends. We're really committed to telling the stories across America. So if you know someone who would be good on the podcast, send an email. 50statesofmindusa@gmail.com or find us on Instagram @50statesofmind. Thanks for listening.